Do please take a seat. We're going to make a start. A very warm welcome and a special welcome if this is your first time on the barge, St. Peter's Barge, London's only floating church. So I'm the minister. My name is Marcus Nodder. Great to have you with us this evening. And this evening is part of a whole series of events called One Thing in Common. And the idea is we get in people from all sorts of walks of life and different jobs and so on. But they have one thing in common, which is their faith in Jesus Christ. And the idea is we interview them for 20, 25 minutes or so. And then after that, there's a short talk, which this evening is on investing for eternity. And our special guest this evening knows all about investing. So he worked for 20 plus years at Credit Suisse, just behind us, in senior management and strategic planning. And he is now the chief executive of Hoare & Co., which is a private bank on Fleet Street. So would you please put your hands together and welcome Jeremy Marshall. Jeremy, we are very grateful indeed for you coming and being here. He was here twice this lunchtime and now this evening. Thank you so much for coming. And you are the chief executive of the oldest private bank in the UK. And I did read this in the papers. It said it was the most profitable bank. Now, I think they mean percentage-wise or something, but how does it feel having this lofty position of chief exec of such an organisation?
It's I think pretty much we're sure it's the oldest wholly owned family bank in the world. So it was founded in 1672, and it's owned nearly 350 years later, still by the same family, by seven members of the Hoare family. And they have unlimited liability. We're the only bank of that type in the UK. Fortunately, that doesn't extend to the chief executive, but that means if the bank gets into financial difficulties, the owners of the bank are personally liable. All of their houses, investments, even the shirt off their back has to be devoted to bail out the bank. So not surprisingly, that's made us very conservative, and that's why we're still here 350 years later.
And you are the first in the whole history of the bank, these 300 plus years, you're the first person to be chief executive who's not a member of the Hoare family. How did you pull that one off?
Well, the family are very surprised about that, I think, still. Every morning they scratch their heads and think, how do we get this chap Marshall? It's a great place to work. The bank has been sort of modernising its corporate governance over the last, say, 10, 20 years. We also have an outside chairman, who's Lord Wilson of Dinton, who used to be the cabinet secretary in the era of Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. So the cabinet secretary, for those of you who don't know the UK system, they are basically the top of the civil service. And they also, as the name implies, take the minutes in the cabinet. Richard was the cabinet secretary on 9/11, which was obviously an interesting experience. And he's a great person. But it's a fantastic place to work. And been there for 5 years, was 21 years at Credit Suisse before, worked in Switzerland, France and the US. So I feel very fortunate really to have had such an interesting career.
Your father was a local church minister, so a church pastor. And did you ever think of following in his footsteps, or were you sort of the black sheep of the family and that's how you went off into banking?
No, I absolutely am. All my family for generations have been either vicars or teachers. So they regard with horror the thought that, there's a banker in the family. I mean, if it was something, like a drug dealer that was less, shocking, but to have a banker is really too much. I never thought of going into the church. I never felt that's what God wanted me to do. I think part of being a Christian is that you feel that God has a plan for your life, and for whatever reason, probably because I wasn't good enough, God said, no, Jeremy, we don't want you in the pulpit, we want you in the dealing floor, or whatever. Where do private bankers hang out? I guess sort of nice panelled halls of classy private banks.
And do you see there's any conflict at all between being a Christian and working in banking and finance?
None at all. I think the Bible teaches us, if you're a Christian, that God made the whole world and God made everything in it. And the Bible opens with God at work. So work is a good thing. We're made to work. And any legal profession, I mean, obviously, for example, being a drug dealer, I think would be hard to be justified if you're a Christian. But any legal profession, Christians should be there. And our job is to be the salt and light, the Bible tells us. And there are not some kind of holy professions like being a vicar or being a doctor or something and some bad ones. I mean, banking obviously has its problems, and we'll come on to that in a minute. But in general, as Christians, we're called to, you know, follow whichever vocation God has called us to. So I know we can be just as I was going to say proud, but we shouldn't be proud. We should be just as content that we're in God's plans in banking or accounting or whatever it is, as in any other profession.
I mean, have you found over the years that there have been any ethical dilemmas you faced in banking as a Christian?
How long have you got, Marcus? I think the war shuts about midnight, doesn't it? Yeah. Yes, a number. I think when ethical decisions present themselves in banking, they typically don't come with a big kind of flashing red light saying, you know, ethical warning. And if you look at what's gone wrong in banking, it's been very insidious and a kind of gentle, gradual process whereby little by little by little things went worse and worse and worse. So I think a typical example of where one would want to apply a Christian perspective is, let's say, which is something you have very often in private banking or in trading and sales, a dispute with a client. For example, a typical dispute is over whether the client placed the order or not, or what exactly they were ordering. And sometimes there's confusion, you know. Thankfully, I don't have to do it anymore, but when I, you know, used to sort of manage some salespeople, used to have to sit and listen for hours to their stupid telephone conversations, sometimes a bit surprising what people get up to on the phone, and in trying to sort of determine what was right. But from a, you know, the pressure is often then to sort of cut the deal in favour of the bank, because that's how you make money. But from a Christian perspective, we're called to an absolute standard of truth, and that means that, you know, and that has challenged me on occasion, that you're called to say, actually, you know, it was our mistake, and to acknowledge that and to pay up. So sometimes, though, ethical dilemmas are a lot more obvious. I can think of other examples. I can think of a particular example where I was asked to do something. I just point blank refused. Absolutely not. I will not do it. But that was probably once in 20 years. And on the whole, most of the ethical challenges are more, you know, that there are grey areas, but once or twice then things come along which you can clearly say, no, that's morally wrong, I can't do that.
I mean, bankers have been in the news a fair bit in recent years, and clearly something has gone wrong. In what way would you say that banking has maybe lost its way in recent years?
Yeah, I think, you know, there can be many ways we can look at that. You can talk about regulation, you can talk about industry structure, but I would say the biggest thing that's changed profoundly over the 30 years I've been in banking, I know some of you will be shocked to hear I'm the wrong side of 50, but I did actually start in the early 80s, is the change in culture. I don't think the old culture of the city in the early 80s was perfect. For example, you know, if you're a woman, it probably wasn't a great place to work, but there was this feeling of my word is my bond. And I think also people had a longer-term perspective. Basically, what kind of came pouring in like water in a flood was really greed. And, you know, the amount of money that's kind of poured into the industry, that has, in my view, generally undermined the sort of moral foundations of banking and led, you know, to 2008. Because greed and sort of our sin, and I'm not saying there are some greedy bankers and others who are holy, we're all in the same boat. If you can compare greed, I would compare it to like petrol coming pouring into a building. And the more petrol you have, the bigger the fire you're going to have. And then it takes, you know, a flame to set the petrol on fire. And in 2008, that was, you know, to do with subprime mortgages and so on. But that was the sort of immediate trigger. The thing that really, I think, undermined banking was a very high level of greed. And that changed that certainly in my lifetime, in 30 years of working in the city, changed the culture radically.
Now, you're a Christian, you're very open about the facts, and just tell us something of your story of how you became a Christian.
Yeah. Well, I was born into a Christian home, as you can imagine, with a father. My father's idea of summer holidays was to take I've got three sisters, to take the four of us Bible smuggling in Russia. So every summer he used to pack his car full of Bibles and off we went Bible smuggling. As a kid, you don't think that, you know, think that's just what most people do. You realise afterwards it was slightly unusual. Yeah, I could go on for hours about strange things that happened in Russia. We never got arrested or anything, but the Russians were, I think, rather surprised to see my father turn up in his battered old Volvo and four children under about 12. But anyway, but being born in a Christian family doesn't make you a Christian. And certainly when I was young, when I was a teenager, I thought church was incredibly boring and dull. And my father, who was quite a strong character, used to insist that we went twice on Sundays and also to Sunday school. So I can tell you, I did not like Sundays, sorry to say. And when I became a Christian, which, you know, when I was a teenager, I would say, I would compare, it's a long time ago, but I would compare it to this. It's like being in a dark room and the light turned on. And the reason that the room was dark was partly just the way we are by nature. We are in the darkness. The Bible tells us that. But also that I think I got very mixed up with things about, you know, the church and other things I didn't like. And if you're here and you're not a Christian and you look at the church, there's probably lots of things you don't like and lots of things you think are odd. And, you know, there's some quite odd people in the church. You've got to admit it. I meant me and you, Marcus, not just you. Don't worry. So what becoming a Christian about is about sort of looking beyond the church and experiencing the reality of Jesus Christ. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's one thing if you read about Jesus and you hear about him where you know, in one way or another sort of are introduced to him. But becoming a Christian is you suddenly realize that he's alive and that he's God. And that changes your life forever. Now, it wasn't a particularly dramatic thing that happened. And, you know, some people do have a kind of Damascus Road experience, you know, Paul on the road to Damascus, sort of blinding light. But in my experience, most people who become Christians, it's a gradual thing. And the thing that's happening is sort of like a skilled fisherman, God is kind of reeling us in to himself. And when you become a Christian, you think, it was me kind of deciding to be a Christian. Actually, you realize afterwards it was God, like a kind of powerful magnet drawing us to himself, which is his kindness, because by ourselves we would go in the opposite direction. So I realize I'm mixing my metaphors, but I would say it was becoming a Christian was both being drawn like a powerful magnet and being in a dark room with the light turned on.
Now, there'll be people here for whom that's all quite new. Christians obviously on a lot about the cross. The cross seems to be a key thing on churches all over the place, and we've got one on the roof here and so on. What does the cross mean to you? Why is the cross the centre of the Christian faith?
Well, first of all, we sort of get used to the cross, don't we? But it was a shocking symbol for Christians to have. In fact, the early church didn't have the cross. They had the fish, because the cross was shameful. It would be like having a kind of, I guess the von der Krunt would be like having an electric chair as the symbol of your church. It was a symbol of execution. I think the cross, the thing that strikes me about the cross is that Jesus went willingly and knowingly to the cross. So some people say it was a terrible accident, sort of like, you know, Mozart was cut short at whatever it was, 35, Jesus was cut short at 33. But that's not what the Bible says. In fact, you've got a copy of Mark there. Mark's whole gospel is oriented towards Jesus having come to die. So Jesus went to the cross willingly. And what motivated him? Well, he was motivated by his love for us, for people who believe in him, because that was the only way that we could be put right with God. That's what the Bible teaches. And that by our own efforts, we can't reach God, but that God paid an incredible price, which was basically to hand over his son, fully God, fully man, the Bible says for some hours, to the devil. And the forces of evil crucified Jesus. But the other side of the cross, of course, is the empty tomb. So that could be the other symbol of the Christian church. It would be difficult to put on the roof of a barge, but you'd have a kind of a big hole a rock next to it.
Do you ever have any doubts about, you know, is it all true or not? And if so, how do you deal with those doubts when they come?
Only about every 10 minutes, Marcus. Yeah. I think any Christian, if you're here and you're not a Christian, if you ask your Christian friend, we absolutely all have doubts. And the reason that we have doubts is that we're human beings. And being a Christian doesn't make you perfect. And I think the thing... If you have a doubt, which you do, about I wouldn't say I typically doubted the existence of God, but you do doubt, you know, some of the things in the Bible, some of the things in the Bible are really easy to understand and some are difficult. And sometimes you think, how can that be so in the Bible when it's so against the grain of the world we live in? And the answer there is not to get hung up on secondary things, but to come back to Jesus Christ. That is the heart of the gospel. And whenever you come back to Jesus and you think about him and you read about him and you talk to him, which is prayer, I know that may sound a bit weird, but that's what praying is. It's just talking to God, and Jesus is God. Then your doubts go away. And the other reason that you have doubts is that we live in a fallen, evil world, and the devil puts doubts in our minds. So, you know, that's just the way we are. The devil doesn't want anybody. The devil hangs on to his prey and doesn't want anyone to escape. So, you know, doubts are planted there in our minds by the devil to try and stop us seeing God. The good news is, if we ask God, which I would absolutely say if you're here and you're not a Christian, God, if you're there, show yourself to me, he will answer. In the Bible it says, if with all your hearts you truly seek me, you will surely find me. So God doesn't hide from us. And if we have doubts and we have questions and problems, if we say, God, I don't understand this, I don't even know if you're there, but if you are there, show yourself to me, I guarantee you that he will answer.
To keep going in your faith and to be growing in your faith, things like reading the Bible, praying, meeting with other believers, it's clearly important. How do you find time to do that in your very busy schedule?
Yeah, I feel bad, honestly, because although I'm kind of okay at reading the Bible up, and you know, you've got these sort of modern iPads and stuff, so you can do it on the train, I really struggle with prayer. I feel convicted that I'm just a terrible, bad prayer. And I would say, though, that when you do pray is when you're in a real mess. And then you're kind of driven to your knees. And that's sort of stupid, isn't it? We should be like that in all times. But, for example, when I was at Credit Suisse, which was the period, you know, last couple of years sort of around the crash, 2007, 2008, I was in a really difficult... It was some of you probably remember, others not, but it was a really, really difficult time. And there was tremendous pressure, also tremendous cost-cutting. And, you know, I kept thinking I'm going to get fired, which in the end I did, actually. Here I am, so I survived. But in situations like that, when you feel intense pressure, then you really pray because you need God. And the dangerous time as a Christian is the opposite of that. So if you're a Christian, everything's going great. You're going from one success to another. That's the time to watch out, because the Bible says... those who think they, you know, if we think we stand, then we may yet fall. So the most important thing as a Christian is to realize our own weakness and our complete dependence on God. It's when we don't realize that, when, like Simon Peter, you remember the story of Peter says, I'm never going to betray you. And, you know, within the next few hours, he's betrayed Jesus three times. So self-confidence and pride is really dangerous as a Christian. On the other hand, when we feel weak, then we realize we need God's help.
You were talking earlier about the greed of bankers, and the Bible says that the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Now, obviously, you're on... I want to put you on the spot and ask you what you're on per year, but probably a little bit more than some here. How do you keep yourself as a believer from the love of money?
Yeah. It's a big challenge, Marcus. And look, I would be lying if, you know, the son of a preacher who... I can tell you, when I started working at Barclays... in 84, I think I was paid £6,000 a year. I know you're shocked at how low it was, but and my father told me some years later that it was far more than he was making. He was like 55. So why did I end up in banking? Well, I'm sure, you know, love of money wasn't you know, a million miles away. So if you're here as a Christian and you're working with money, you need to watch out, because money is inherently dangerous. And if you think, you know, if you spend all your time, which as Christians we shouldn't do, looking at pornography, then it creates lust, which is a sin. So if we spend all our time working with money and thinking about money, the danger is we end up greedy. On the positive side, though, you know, as Christians, if God has given you a job, then that's a great opportunity to use that for, you know, A, his kingdom, for gospel work, and B, you know, to help others. And I'm personally involved in support various charities, and, you know, some are Christian, some not. But I do think that if you're a Christian, you will meet God one day, and he will say to you, Jeremy, Marcus, whatever your name is, you know, I gave you this money, and what did you do with it? And we're accountable to God for that money. So we're stewards. It's God's money. He's given it to us. So we need to live and, you know, have houses and stuff. That's fine. But if you're not sure, then, well, how much, you know, the biblical rule is, in my view, at least 10%. And I think, sorry to say this, it should be 10% of the pre-tax income, not post-tax. Anyway, if you need more guidance on that, talk to Marcus afterwards. But that's my view.
Work-life balance is an issue people talk about a lot. Have you got any wisdom on that, just over from your 30-plus years in banking and so on? I mean, you've got the demands of work, you've got church, you've got family.
Yeah.
How have you managed to balance all these things without ending up sacrificing everything on the altar of work, which is what can be the default setting for
me? I'm not sure I have. If my wife was here, she might seize the microphone at this point and say, let me tell you a few things, because we've been married 26 years, and there were definitely times when she got... And I was just working like crazy and, you know, probably like some of you, I'm by nature quite ambitious. And my wife got really fed up, and I think she was quite right, because I was, you know, had the wrong priorities. Because the Bible tells us that the priority should be God, family, work. But, you know, because of the way work is, and especially in an environment like Canary Wharf, we tend to turn that round. And, you know, families are important things. You know, if you've got... We've got three children, they're teenagers now, but when they were young children, you can't go back in a year and say, I'm sorry I missed the last year of your life, but now I'm here. And we've got to put work in its place. It's important, but if it becomes a kind of a monster, and the reason it becomes a monster is because of our ambition, then it's wrong. We're building it into what the Bible calls an idol. We're making it basically into God. Let me give you an example, which would be, you know, things like children's sports days and, you know, plays and stuff. Now, if you miss a child's sports day or a school play, 6 months later, you will have forgotten the work reason that made you miss it. But that child will probably never forget that as long as they live. So getting priorities in the right place is really, really important. And the time to start it is when you start out in the work. Because what happens, sadly, is lots of people, you know, end up getting divorced, often because one or both of them is, you know, built work into such a thing that they got no time for their spouse, and it's just not worth it. Nobody on there, when I left Credit Suisse, I gave a little speech, and I quote, I don't know, it's not in the Bible, but it should be. It says, nobody on their deathbed wishes they'd spend more time in the office, and that's true, I think.
How about the local church? Because clearly in the Bible, the local church is absolutely key to God's purposes of reaching a lost world. How have you found you've been able to make that a priority in all the demands of your life over the years?
Well, one really good thing is to have, you know, more than one local church. So we live in Seven Oaks, we have a local church here. But I think being in a ministry like this, or there's lots of different, you know, things at the city, is fantastic. In fact, I was, as you know, Marcus, I was sort of one of the people involved I was even here before you were, you know, a long time ago, and setting up the barge. And the great thing, I think, if you're a Christian for things like this, is it's really, you know, a golden opportunity to invite people along to things, as some of you have, because it's very hard if you live in Seven Oaks or Kensington or wherever you live, St Albans or something, to say, you know, to a friend who lives somewhere else, come along. But we're called as Christians to bring our faith into practical application to our work. And therefore, I think these kind of, you know, having a local church local to where you work is really important. And it's really encouraging, because we are all busy, and we kind of plunge like a diver into a swimming pool at 8 o'clock in the morning, or maybe some of you start even earlier and kind of re-emerge at the end of the day. So taking that, you know, hour, half an hour every week is really good. Good habits are really good. So I think, you know, things like the barge and other local churches in the workplace, terrific.
Some people who are Christian would say that they feel reticent to be open about their faith in the workplace. How have you found that over the years? Have you just been very open about the fact that you're a Christian and you tell people what you believe and sort of leave the results to God, or have you played it?
Well, I wish I did more, but it's a lot easier, like, if you're the chief executive than if you're in the mailroom or something. But I think everybody at the place I work knows I'm a Christian. And look, the way I would see it is this. Imagine you had some kind of terrible disease and you have a cure, but you don't tell anybody about it. I mean, that's insanity. And by the way, this medicine, this super drug, is free. So as a Christian, we have a responsibility because we are all suffering under a disease, and the disease is within us, which is sin. And we have the answer. So if we don't tell people, shame on us. I think we should just be bold. I wish I'd been bolder, I guess, over the last 30 years. I think of a friend of mine, you probably know him, Ben Stone. So this will encourage, those of you who are Christians, this should encourage you to be very bold. So Ben is quite a character, wrote this little kind of pamphlet about, it's actually about Warren Buffett, applying Warren Buffett's principles to the Christian faith. And he worked at Schroeder's, and he went around to like 600 people one morning and left a copy of this book on everybody's chair, okay? So very bold. And the HR function went nuts. They threatened to fire him, and they said, this is an outrage, you can't do that. We want you to go around to every single person in Schroeder's who you've left a copy of the book on their chair and apologise to them. Well, this turned out to be the most fantastic evangelistic opportunity you've ever seen in your life. So first of all, people said, what book? I didn't see a book. So Ben said, this book. Oh, okay, thank you. Other people said, HR made you apologise? What's it to do with them? It's not. I'll do what I like. I don't need HR telling me what to do. So Ben ended up having hundreds and hundreds of really great conversations. So God takes our sort of, you know, inept attempts, doesn't he? And he uses them. So if we take one step in faith, God will match that with 1,000 of his own.
There's a scene very similar to that in Jerry Maguire, but I digress. In terms of how your faith affects the way that you do your job day by day, what sort of things? You mentioned some things earlier on, but are there practical ways that affects you do your job in banking because you are a Christian?
I hope so, because you should probably ask my colleagues who would probably say no. But I think, you know, it's hopeless having a faith which only exists on, you know, the weekend. So if we just have a faith that's on Saturdays and Sundays, and then it's not there for the rest of the week, that's absolutely useless. So we've got to. And what would be a good example? I guess, you know, treating people well when you have to let them go, which is the worst aspect of banking, and it's happened to me. I know how it is. I think, you know, trying to. The worst thing that can happen to you in work is to get fired. So especially there, I think, as a Christian, you've got to really try and be sympathetic or understanding. Or where people, you know, there's a recent case I can think of where people, you have to move, you know, maybe take someone out of a job and put them in a different job, just to try and do it in a decent, honest way. And sometimes it means also telling them yourself. I mean, we talked about HR, but it's very easy to kind of hide behind HR. So if you've got bad news, to tell people, to try and tell them yourself.
On the subject of bad news, I mean, you were due to come to the barge back in the spring. You were taken ill and rushed to hospital. Just tell us a bit about what happened then.
Yeah, so it was about a year ago, almost to the day. So I just, you know, I felt a lump on my side. And my wife said, you know, being a typical man, I said, oh, it's nothing. She said, no, you must go to the doctor, which was a good thing she said that. You always listen to your wife. It's a good principle of life. And so I went to the GP. He said, oh, it's nothing. It's just when you get to your age, Jeremy, you get these fatty lumps. Don't worry, it's nothing. So he said, we'll just get it. Give you an ultrasound. We'll just get it checked out. And then you kind of get bounced around between lots and lots of different doctors and, you know, specialists. And they all say, oh, I don't know really what that is. We better have some more tests. So to kind of cut a long story short, it was cancer. And I had two operations and then, you know, radiotherapy. Hopefully, you know, God willing, you know, that's it. But, you know, once you've got it, obviously you never really know. The biggest difficulty in dealing with cancer is fear, I would say. I mean, obviously, fear you're going to die. Especially, I would say, with young children. You're going to see your children grow up. Plus, you know, obviously the act of dying is not, especially from cancer, is not a happy one for those of you who've had, you know, relatives or friends who do that. So, but the biggest enemy is fear. It's up here, really, more than here. Because when you go for an operation, you don't really know anything. You just, you know, wake up some hours later and you feel a bit sore. There's a really good story in the Bible which kind of was impressed on me, which was, you know, Jesus said to his disciples one day, let's go to the other side of the lake. So they all got in the boat and off they sailed. Well, the story, the Bible tells us that a great storm arose And so much so that the disciples, who were all really skilled fishermen and sailors, thought the boat was going to sink. And meanwhile, Jesus was fast asleep in the stern on a pillow, because as well as being God, he's man, and he was tired like us. So the disciples were sort of beside themselves, and they went, you know, pretty roughly to Jesus and shook him and said, you know, don't you care that we're going to drown? And Jesus woke up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and immediately it became a great calm, which is a supernatural intervention of God. Because if you know anything about the sea or a big lake, the wind may stop, but the sea doesn't stop. So that was billions and billions of molecules of water being rearranged instantaneously. And the disciples were even more afraid after that than they were afraid in the storm, because they began to dawn on them, who is this man who is in the boat? Of course, they came to realize eventually it was God. So as a Christian, if you like, we have Jesus in our boat, in our life. But the really scary thing as a Christian is maybe sometimes God appears asleep, because it appears to me, I don't know, that, you know, that the cancer's gone. I hope so, anyway. But it may come back, or eventually something else will get us. So the real test of our faith is when God doesn't answer our prayers. But the encouraging thing there is that the story doesn't end with the water being still. It ends with, and they came to the other side. So the other side for us is death, and we're all going to die. And if you're a Christian, you have the security of knowing that whatever happens, however you die, you will wake up and you will see Jesus Christ. That is a wonderful security. But it also, I have to say, when you go through cancer, even with that, it's a test of your faith. And the good thing is that God draws near to you and makes himself very present to you. And God gives us grace to experience when we need it. He doesn't give us grace for hypothetical situations, but when we're in the storm, then he's with us.
There's lots more I'd love to ask, but time is rushing on. We want to leave you some time to speak to us now about investing for eternity, and then there may be a few moments before we close for questions from the floor. So
great.
Thanks,
Jeremy.
So a bit of audience participation. Who likes Marmite? Okay. And who hates Marmite? That's interesting. You must be a Marmite-loving congregation, because this morning we had two talks and they were much more evenly balanced. So people think of the Christian faith, don't they, as like Marmite. Some people are Marmite lovers, kind of Christians, and some people are not. And some people are born into, like me, into kind of Marmite-loving households. And some people are born in, you know, households where Marmite is never mentioned and stuck away at the back of the shelf. So it's a kind of a personal preference. But that's not what the Bible says. If you want an image of it, which is a sad image of what the Bible says the world is like, it's not like Marmite, it's like the Westgate Shopping Centre in Nairobi. Because we live in a beautiful world, like a wonderful shopping mall with all kinds of fantastic things, and we have, at least in the West, money to go and buy it. And we have our family and we're enjoying ourselves, but death is in the mall and we can't get out. And obviously, all of us, as I said, are going to die. So the question I have for you is, what are you investing your life in? Which is, if you like, a kind of private banking type question. And Jesus has something to say about this. In Mark 8, he says, Jesus called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? So this is really investment advice. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet lose their soul? Because if you accept the Christian claim that Jesus is God, then Jesus can see into eternity. In fact, he made everything, including time. And he knows what's going to happen. I hope this doesn't come as a shock to you that even the best private bankers don't know, which is why we make mistakes and lose money on bad investments. But Jesus says that we have a soul.
and that we're not animals, but we're made in the image of God, which means men and women are made somehow to be like God. And God has placed eternity in our hearts, the Bible said, and we will never find rest until we find rest in Him. And if we try and fill that kind of God-made hole with other things, we will never be satisfied. And I can tell you from my experience in private banking that many of the most miserable and depressed people I've met are very, very wealthy people. Money doesn't make you happy. Let me give you an example of this. There was a man called Somerset Maugham, who was a famous writer, the sort of J.K. Rowling of his day, I guess, in the period before the Second World War. And he was still alive at the end of the 1970s. His nephew, Robin Maugham, went to visit him, and he wrote, this was, I'm quoting from the Times newspaper. Robin Maugham said, "I looked around the drawing room at the immensely valuable furniture and pictures and objects that Uncle Willie's success had enabled him to acquire. I remembered the villa itself and the wonderful garden I could see through the windows, a fabulous setting on the edge of the Mediterranean worth millions. Willie had 11 servants." I don't know, anyone here have 11? Even at Hawes Bank, we don't have any, but we certainly don't have 11 anyway. And he had a wonderful cook who was the envy of all the other millionaires on the Riviera. But it no longer meant anything to him. The article goes on. "The following afternoon, I found Willie reclining on a sofa, peering through his spectacles at a Bible which had very large print. He looked horribly wizened. His face was grim. 'You know, Robin, I've been reading the Bible. I've come across the quotation. What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? You know, my dear Robin, that text used to hang opposite my bed when I was a child. Of course, it's all a lot of rubbish, but the thought is interesting all the same.'" Robin Maugham goes on to describe an empty, bitter old man who repeatedly fell into shrieking terrors, crying, "Go away, I'm not ready. I'm not dead yet." He was a man who gained the whole world and lost his soul. So the Bible tells us that we have a soul, and not only that we have a soul, but that we can lose it. And we lose it by rejecting God's free offer. So one day you will meet God, and He will say to you, on that evening in October 2013, "You heard my message." Whether or not you answer that invitation is up to you. One big misunderstanding that people have, in fact the biggest misunderstanding by far, is that the way we avoid losing our soul, or the way we're accepted by God, is by being good. And they think that Christians think that we're kind of morally upright people, and it's a good thing I'm on a platform, we kind of look down on these inferior, immoral people who do all kinds of terrible things. But actually, Christians are just as bad as anybody else. There's nothing inherently better about a Christian at all. The only difference between a believer and a non-believer is the Christian has realized, sort of like me with that lump, that there's something terribly wrong with them and that they urgently need help. And that brings me to the third and final point. One, we have a soul. Two, we can lose it, because ultimately God will say to us, "Okay, you rejected my offer. I give you the consequences of your decision. I accept your decision." But the way that we save our soul is what we were talking about earlier, which is coming back to Westgate Mall. Jesus came on a rescue mission. Did you read that story about that man who went into the mall? He wasn't in the mall. He was out as a Kenyan security guard. And he went into the mall armed with a pistol, and he started to fight the terrorists. And he, you know, there was that picture of that little girl running across the kind of corridor to him. And he got masses and masses of people out of the mall. Well, that is a good picture of Jesus, with two exceptions. One, that Jesus wasn't only outside the mall, he was God. So that God had purposed from before the beginning of the world to send his son to be born in order to have him die on a cross to rescue us. And secondly, that obviously that man got out, but Jesus knew he was coming to die. And becoming a Christian, there's a lot more that one could say, but it's really about nothing more than this. It's about believing that Jesus is the Son of God, and putting your trust and faith in him. And that is a kind of maybe a more active thing than we might think, because we think of belief as in, I believe it's going to stop raining, or at least kind of I hope it's going to stop raining. But belief is also about trusting in God. It's about repenting from what we've done wrong, because those sins that we've done wrong, those are the very things that nailed Jesus to the cross. So we can't come to Jesus and say we bring all our sins with us. As I've tried to explain in a faltering and limited way, we struggle with that sin that is within us, but we must also nail our sin to the cross. And then try and live as we can as a Christian. And the Christian faith is about, as I tried to explain in my case, it's about meeting the reality of Jesus Christ, and that he is alive, and that I believe, if you think this is a bit weird, you can ask me a question about it. I believe he's here in this room now. I believe we can't see him, but through the Holy Spirit, that Jesus Christ is here. So I invite you to meet him. And if you think, well, you know, some things are interesting, but some things are plain mad that this crazy banker was saying, then I would invite you to do a course. There's a good course that Marcus runs called Christianity Explored, which is nothing more than just going through Mark's gospel. And it's not exactly a very long gospel to read. It's pretty thin. And that's really Jesus' teaching, some of the stuff we've talked about and more than that, and about Jesus' death and resurrection. Thanks for listening. If you've got time, Marcus, happy to take a few questions.